Is it possible for three collectors to come up with one free watch collection? To answer the challenge, we have Vince and Rich here today, and I'm Chris, the creator of the Three Watch Collection channel. Welcome back, gents.
Thanks very much.
Yeah, thanks for having us back.
Is it reasonable to aim for a three watch collection, or do you need more than three watches as a serious collector?
Well, I think I'll say, don't want to start by saying, is it reasonable just to have one watch? Probably.
Like, should be.
Most people can get away with one watch. Why would we go for three? Well, I think the last time we spoke about it, for you like your dress watch, you like your do anything watch, and probably your holiday watch type of thing. And then you get sucked in.
Probably for normal people, it's unreasonable to spend this sort of money on a item that you don't actually need.
Yeah, I think you build up the unreasonableness. It's a bit like working out your muscles at the gym. You have to work on them to get more and more unreasonable with your investment. But I think theoretically, for a real hardcore enthusiast, I think it is theoretically possible to have a three watch collection for sure. I mean, I think the three watches we're going to talk about today would be a killer collection. But I think part of the difficulty is you build up sentimental value with lots of your different pieces, and then they might not be perfect for your three watch collection anymore, but you don't want to part with them either. That's one of the barriers, certainly for me anyway. If I've tried to pare it down to three, I could think of three amazing watches which would work as a collection, but then I'd have to part ways with other pieces which I've built a lot of memories with, which would be the hard part.
Pretty, very true. And I'm just looking at these watches here thinking to myself, would that be enough? I don't think it would. I know you say, Rich, they'd be a killer collection for most people. But unfortunately, you get into this game, for want of a better way, and you get sucked in sometimes, or you just actually quite like what you do. It's a hobby. Some people do jigsaws, other people do metal work. I collect watches. Would I class myself as a collector? Probably not. I couldn't say I'm a collector, but I'm an enthusiast. I like watches. I like to wear them, and I like to change them on a regular basis.
I do find myself gravitating towards like very, very few watches in my collection when it actually comes to wearing. So like some watches you do like to own, but for me, when I go to my watch box, it's always like two, three pieces that I actually pick out and wear most of the time.
Sounds like there might be a three watch collector kind of hidden inside, deep inside there, Chris.
Probably it would be very, very difficult to get down to three for me as well. Wow. Have more than three watches, but less than what I used to have. It's nice to condense what you like into fewer pieces that you actually enjoy and not just store.
I agree. I think it's difficult to put a number on it, but certainly consolidation is a concept I like, of trying to, rather than have as many pieces as possible, try and figure out the pieces which you enjoy the most and use other pieces to kind of elevate the pieces that you want to be the core of your collection. So getting it down to three would be a bit difficult, but that concept of consolidation is one that does appeal to me. Sometimes it could be questioned when we are in consolidation, when we're acquiring more watches. It's a little bit hard to see, but there is that often desire when you talk to other enthusiasts, I want to pare it down to what's really important to me.
All right, let's have a look at what we have here.
Let's do it.
So I love dress watches. I gravitate towards dress watches. I think everybody needs a dress watch. So let's start with the dress watch that we have on the table.
Sure. Okay. So I brought along this JLC Perpetual Calendar Master Control Series from JLC. A few things about the watch. In terms of the movement, it is JLC's 889 base time only movement. And then they have combined that with a module for the Perpetual Calendar, which Kurt Klaus developed for IWC. I think it was the late 1980s. Those two movements combined, you then have a perpetual calendar with a moon phase. I think just mechanical watches in general have a little bit of magic to them, the way they can accurately track time with a series of springs and gears. And then when you take that to the level of a perpetual calendar, it's just magic upon magic. Keep track of the date and time and moon phase and day of the week and month of the year for over 100 years without need of any intervention. It is an amazing complication, and it's one that's usually outside the price accessibility of someone in my bracket, certainly. This particular one in steel, so that helps with it making it more accessible. It's not in precious metal like a lot of perpetual calendars. It was one that they produced from, I think, the late 90s, around 96 maybe, through to 2008. And then they discontinued it and they brought in another replacement in around 2013. No disrespect to anyone who has the newer one, but I do prefer this one in terms of its balance and proportions. They changed the dial layout a little bit, but this one I did.
The moon phase is at 12 o'clock.
Yeah, that's right. And they've got an aperture kind of in the corner for the year. To me, to my eyes, it throws off the symmetry a little bit. You know, us enthusiasts can get fussy about little things. So this one I think is just a lovely symmetry to it, and probably a grail perpetual calendar for me is Patek's 3940, but that's a sort of $100,000 watch these days, and this one is a fraction of that, but it feels to me like JLC's kind of take on the format.
So Rich, could I ask you about the complication? Have you ever tried explaining the complication to somebody who's not a watch person?
Yeah, I have.
What response do you get?
They're usually pretty impressed when you're talking to people who aren't watch people. They're a bit aghast at spending all this money on telling the time.
Yeah.
But when you kind of explain this particular complication, they do kind of, even if they're not into watches, they kind of can get in a little bit of the amazement on, well, how the heck does it do that?
Yeah.
It's like a tiny little thing.
And it is amazing.
Yeah.
At the brains that went into that.
It's technically a mechanical computer.
It is.
Yeah.
And there's a romance to that even people that aren't already in the camp can sometimes kind of get a little spark. There's usually a mix of a bit of being impressed and also a bit of kind of amusement of this guy's a bit crazy, but it is an amazing thing.
And if you compare it with your Patek, you don't have the pushers on the case sides.
No, it's a little bit different. It's what's called a fixed perpetual calendar format. So all the date, the day, the year, and the moon phase all go ahead together at once. So you can't have a day which doesn't match the week, which doesn't match the moon phase, well, so to speak.
So can you set the wrong time and cause problems with that one?
No. You can't. So it'd always be a real point in time. But if you push it too far ahead, it can't go backwards.
So you have to wait.
Yeah. So.
Or send it back to you.
Yeah. If you
wait 10 years sometimes.
Yeah. So if you had a really malicious person who both was a watch enthusiast and also didn't like you, they could just push that thousands of times, and you'd be in a bit of trouble. You'd need to.
Can't accidentally do it because I've never worn one of those. But
no. You need a little poking thing to compress it. But if you did have that particular situation, you could send it back to. You can send it back to JLC and they can service it. That would be your option there.
If I remember correctly, there was this exchange between JLC and IWC that JLC provided the base movements to IWC and IWC the Kurt Klaus module.
Yes.
But what I'm impressed with, though, is the thinness of the watch. If you look at IWC perpetual calendars, it's the same system, but they're chunky.
Yeah.
And I think when it comes to dress watch, it can be chunky.
Yeah, it's an elegant thing, that one. I think because the 889 was an ultra slim movement, I guess combining it with the Kurt Klaus module, it still retains its slenderness. And but yeah, you're right. They did sort of have some cross-pollination back at that time. And I think this 889 time-only movement went into the Mark 12 or Mark 12 or 13, the pilot's watch from around the early 90s. So there was the JLC movement in the famous IWC pilot watch, and then there was the Kurt Klaus perpetual calendar in this JLC. So I think there was some joint ownership of the groups around the early to mid 90s, and particularly this older model in the 37mm size as well for the diameter. They upped the size a bit with the diameter to go with modern trends in the one that came out in 2013. But for me, 37mm and a sort of, it's about a 10mm thickness is fantastic for a dress watch.
If we wanted to be very traditional, we wouldn't have a complication on a dress watch.
No. Well, yeah, that's true. If you want to go black tie, I think it's time only is the strict. The strict code, but we won't be too down to that.
Yeah. I think nowadays people wear divers with suits, so
yeah,
you can get away with it.
Yeah, I don't think someone's going to turn you out.
No.
Rich, go away.
And I think the case of this watch is so traditional and simple that you can wear it with anything.
Yeah, I think this could be your one dress watch, and you'd be very well placed.
Well, Rich, just one last question. I'll remember the last question.
Yep.
Well, that's an exceptional condition.
Mm-hmm.
How do you keep it like that?
I generally wear this watch in, you know, to the office or going out to a restaurant or something like that. I don't take out in the bush. I'm fortunate enough to have a few other watches. Which,
gardening.
Yeah, not gardening. I don't really try actively to protect it, but I think I must have a bit of a sixth sense where I do keep it relatively.
Which probably answers the question why we want more than three watches.
Yeah. Well, there's that. So, but yeah, it's in pretty good condition. But if you look at it closely, there's some fine.
Very fine
stuff.
Very
fine. Yeah.
You obviously want something that can take a bit of a beating or at least go swimming.
Swimming, yes.
Let's do diver.
Look, this is not a thin watch. This is a relatively thick watch, as you can see. It's a, yes. But what I would say about this watch is, and I'll be a little bit provocative here, I would think this is the most important watch that Tudor ever produced.
Yeah, I would agree. And just put them back on the map.
That's what it did. There's also the debate, because it came in, this is the 79220 Tudor, smiley face as they call it, because of the dials or the text in it is done in a kind of a semicircle or a half a circle, like a smile. It's quite nice. This was the first of them. This was released in about 2012, went on to about 2015, 2016, I think.
Mm-hmm.
It was followed by, which I happen to have, the blue version of it, but then came out the black. So that was the 79220N for Noir. And that that he was there for 6 months, thereabouts. I reckon it was in the low thousands, maybe 3,000 to 4,000 produced, and hence that has become quite a valuable watch. I still argue this should be the valuable one, because this is the one that started it. This is the one that kick-started everything. Without this watch, the black one wouldn't exist.
Yeah, I agree. I think the black one was it was an accidental collector's piece, and that they brought in the in-house movement soon after they released the black one.
Yeah,
but I'm glad you brought that one, Vince, because Tudor was this watch came out right as I was getting much more interested in mechanical watches, and it's still a classic today. And as you said, it had such an impact on Tudor, but also the broader market as well.
Yeah, and I think without this watch, Tudor may not be doing so well today. I'm not saying they wouldn't be producing watches, but I don't think they'd be doing as well as they are doing. And anybody who's new to Tudor and buying a new Tudor, it's just nice to know the history as to what, you know, how the Pelagus has come about, how this new Heritage watch has come about, and the Black Bay 58 are all based on this one here.
Yep.
So the look.
Yeah, if you look at their website, it's clear that what the Black Bay means to Tudor.
Yes, yeah. The other thing about that is the black one, which is deemed to be the most valuable one. Really, the only difference, three differences that I know of, and that's the dial is, or the bezel is black, the tube insert is black, and there's a rather on a 12 o'clock marker is red. But apart from that, it's the only difference.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's a lot of black divers out there as well, but there's not many that I know that have this beautiful kind of wine red hue to them.
Yeah.
I think rouge is the French.
That's right.
The French word is. It's absolutely stunning. And it looked so cool in 2012, or I think it was around 2012.
Yeah.
And today it's still...
Could you imagine that was like when that came out in 2012?
Yeah, it was it was considered a bit of a risk, but it kind of combined heritage dive models with a real kind of fresh take on it. And it's a winner.
So the other great thing about that is it's still Tudor from about 2050 onwards had the Rolls logo. So the Rolls was in the shield. Now, the latest Tudors, as we know, has just got the shield.
Yeah.
Well, that one just has the rose. And I think that's the last watch, that and the other two that came after in the same series, that has the rose. And it has the rose also on the crown as well.
Yeah. They've kept the rose on the crown for the newer ones, but they've got the shield on the dial, which is kind of the main thing. And I kind of wish they'd stuck with the rose, to be honest. The shield doesn't look bad. I've got a BB58, which has the shield, and it looks fine, but the rose has a bit of romance to it.
And I've heard it's been said, you know, if you do a bit of searching into it, that this bridges the gap between history and modern day. It's always heritage and modern day watchmaking with Tudor. That's the one that bridges the gap. So it's pulled a lot of the aesthetics and a lot of the, I suppose, the assembly of the 50s onwards. And that's what it's come up with.
Yeah.
So it's really not a one-for-all or a one-for-one heritage on anything in particular.
No.
It has...
Greatest hit.
It is the greatest. That's a great way of looking at it. Yes, it's a greatest hits, yes. Some people might call it a mismatch, but
it's a cool watch.
It's a very, very good watch.
Do you consider it more as your diver, beater, or more of a collector's piece?
Look, I'm wearing this today as well, just to kind of give some comparison. I don't have the black one. And another reason is I'd like people to actually start buying this one. And so the black one becomes cheaper, so I can actually buy the black one to add to the collection.
With your growing sort of power as an influencer, I think you could make that happen.
Yeah, it's difficult enough to get. And it's difficult to get one that's not fake. There's a few of them out there that are fakes at the moment. And they do say, I don't think it's done, but there is a Black Bay 79220 book done by Millenary Watches. And it talks about these three watches. And they say it is quite easy to change the black or the red into the black, quite easy. The most difficult one would be, and I'll just pull it out here for, I don't know if you can see it on camera, but it's that color would be black and in the cloud salmon. It's very difficult to change that. Sure. So you can't buy one officially off Tudor, I'm told, but maybe somebody has one. But to change this one into a black one, it's a bit of work, but it can be done.
Yeah. You know better than me, Vince, but the Tudor, hadn't been selling watches in the US for quite some time, and then at that period when this watch came out, and the Heritage Chronograph as well, and the Ranger, I think around the same time, was sort of their relaunch to the US market. And though all those watches, but this one in particular, did so well for them that it kind of set off the meteorite that became kind of the whole vintage craze of the 2012 to probably.
You are right, Rich. They stopped production in, because they weren't selling well, they stopped production in America and Australia.
Yeah.
But look how they're selling now.
When you start collecting or get into watches, you look at specs a lot more. Because when you get in deeper down the rabbit hole, it's less about specs and more about heritage, history, significance. Because if you compare this to the in-house movement, that has more watchmaking per se. So this is a 2824 base. For me, I like that it's slimmer than the house.
Yeah.
I think it's chunky enough as is.
Oh, it's chunky, yeah.
I personally don't mind, because a dive watch, you don't expect it to be too slim, right? But the in-house has more power reserve, anti-magnetic properties, and in-house, which is a thing now. And we're talking about this one. That's the more significant. And this is the one that you want to collect.
And look, at the end, if I send that back to Tudor now, if that ETA goes, they'll replace our Rosalita now, because the ETA, they can't buy ETAs anymore because they're not part of the Swatch Group.
Yeah.
So it'll come back with Rosalita. Is that a problem? To me, it's not a problem. It's and they actually are done it. They've done seemingly a great job on this new Rosalita. One thing about this, and it reminds me of the Explorer 2 as well, and I often wonder if that should be brushed. Here, because that does, well, this one is not too bad, but I do know. But even with the Explorer 2, which is a similar approach, it's polished here.
Yeah.
I often wonder if that should
agree.
Be brushed.
I've had that kind of contemplating for a number of dive watches or tool watches in general, where I think it's partly my preference that tool watches be just quite toolish and utilitarian, but they seem to always want to put a bit of polish somewhere.
Yeah. And I think that's not a great place for the polish.
No.
It's a Rolex heritage, because Tudor subs used to use Rolex cases.
That's what it is. Yeah. No, it's a throwback from Rolex without it, no?
And Rolex doesn't do reissue, doesn't do heritage. It's all Tudor.
I know Tudor made their old cases now, so they don't turn.
Yeah. Well, the new Ranger that they brought out maybe 18 months, 2 years ago, that they went all brushed for that, which was a bit of a revelation in our little world for them to just not put any polish on the case at all.
Yeah.
It's nice to see them kind of going in that direction a little bit. But I agree with you. I'd like it to be brushed, but I'd say the same about my Submariner and my BB58 and pretty much any tool watch. I just prefer it to be brushed, but that doesn't that they know more about selling watches than we do, and
they probably know that you need a little bit of flash somewhere on the watch to sell it to the masses.
I suppose it has to have that richness about it,
shiny with luxury.
Yeah, well, it has the price of a luxury item, so it should look the part.
Yeah, well, I suppose people would comment to say that with an ETA movement, why would you pay so much money for that? But I suppose again, it goes back to what you said, Chris. It's the watch is one thing, but it's the history, it's the story, it's the if this gets handed on to somebody else down the track, there is a story to it.
It is a ETA, but it's a great workhorse movement for a time only watch. Those movements can be close or within chronometer.
Yes, they say they are close, but it's not certified.
Yeah. But I mean, it's a tool watch, it's a workhorse, and that was Tudor's history as well. That they used to have the Rolex cases on and parts on the outside, but inside there'd be an ETA movement. So it kind of continues that heritage as well.
Yeah. So when it comes to heritage, history, I think it's hard to argue against the Speedmaster as the third piece of the collection. And for me, of the current references, this one is a special one.
Great.
So this is the Ed White 3-2-1. So why I went for this one? This is a recent purchase for me, and honestly, I do like Speedmasters, but this one just feels special. I'm a bit of a movement junkie, so I do look at movements.
See?
And so the 3-2-1 was introduced in 1941. This same movement base was used by Holy Trinity watches. So Patek Vacheron AP used the same chronograph movement as the 3-2-1. And Omega put it in dressy watches, and they put it in the Speedmaster in 57. And they introduced the first Omega in space in 59. And this was worn by Ed White on his first space book. Hence the name of the case. So this is a different case to the professional one. It doesn't have the lyre lugs, doesn't have the crown guards, and it's smaller. So the professional is 42. This is just under 40, which is my preference.
Yeah.
Honestly, I have a larger wrist, but I just prefer like traditionally sized watches. And the movement in 68 was discontinued, the 3-2-1, because it was just too expensive to make for Omega. They wanted something that can be mass produced and cheaper. So they came out with the 861, which is still, well, it's a derivative of the 861, is still in the current professional model. So they discontinued it in 68, and they didn't put it in a steel case, Speedmaster, until 2 years ago, 3 years ago, they had 21. And it's not only that, but what makes this special for me, I'm a bit of a independent watchmaker fan, as you might know.
You know.
So for me, in the sea of industrial production, when I pay this sort of money, I want to know that an actual watchmaker worked on my watch and Omega very wisely and set up a specific workshop just for the 3-2-1s. So it's one watchmaker, one watch. And
very unique.
Yeah, the other thing I like about this watch is, as much as I appreciate vintage watches, I like to wear my watches. And the Flatling bracelet, if you compare this one to a vintage one, this is a solid modern bracelet with milk clasp, no issues wearing it, whereas the original was just dainty. This one has a sapphire crystal, which makes it much easier to wear. Ceramic bezel insert, which is not available no Speedmasters, but it still looks the part.
It does, yeah. It's a stunning watch, and it's all modern materials, as you just mentioned. But it just looking at it, it looks like a new old stock from the 1960s. Not that I was around then, but I imagine that's the case. Yeah, you've created a bit of a problem for me here, Chris, because I thought I would be more than happy with a Speedy Pro, which I still would be very happy with a Speedy Pro, but I think this is just takes how special it is up another few notches, and particularly when you flip the watch over and look at that movement, it's just
And for me, what's important is when you put it on your wrist, it just feels so good.
Yeah. Yeah.
And for me, it's all about that at the end of the day, how it feels on the wrist. Yeah. As much as I like a watch and I like many, many watches.
Like a good shoe.
It has to fit.
Yeah.
And this just feels so nice on the wrist.
Yeah, it was cool of Omega to revisit the movement after all that time. It was such a big brand to kind of cater to a very focused way to the enthusiasts, and put in a fair bit of time and expense to reproducing that movement was not something you'd expect.
And like with everything, they scan the original movement, so the parts are recreated with modern manufacturing methods. And for example, the copper parts are now Sedna gold plated, so they look the same.
So 3D printed, are you telling me?
It's really scanned. They actually scan the original movement. But again, with all modern manufacturing techniques, you don't have to worry about it as a vintage watch. The only problem with this one is the price. Omega is getting less and less shy with pricing nowadays.
Yeah, well, you're seeing it with the Richemont Group watches, the JLC and IWC, which fall under them. They've really rocketed ahead. But yeah, Omega as well.
But even as people refer to as entry, you know, whatever an entry, you know, Tissot was getting expensive, Longines is getting expensive.
When you go buy a watch, what do you look for? What is important? Is it the complication, the completing a set?
Look, if I stop you there, on this particular one, yes, it's completing the set. Only because of the history, because of the heritage, and because when I started with the blue one, I fell in love with that. And then I said, God, now do I have two? I really need a third one now just to make the collection. I should have stuck with just the blue one, and that was it, the one in the middle. So I had one, but I go for the three. Would they be my three? We haven't asked this question, but I'm a kind of rhetorical question to myself. Are they the three watches that I would stick with? Probably not. That's a collection that will probably sit in a safe somewhere for many, many years, and I'll take them out from time to time. So it goes back to, we still haven't answered that conundrum of a question. Could you have three watches?
Yeah, it would be hard. They would have to be very, very good watches. The way we put this together is one approach when you just want to cover all bases.
Yeah.
But how long does it last, your happiness with a certain watch, and then, you know, you start to get the itch again?
Mm-hmm. And that's a great question. Do you use the term happiness? Do watches make you happy?
I think there's an endorphin surge when you get a new watch, and there's excitement of that. But I think if you keep on chasing that all the time, it gets very, very expensive. So yeah, I think you need to try and eventually kind of not think so much about that excitement of the new purchase and try and think about more as the watches that you want to live with long term. At least that's the way I think about
it. Like a dopamine, isn't it, I'd say?
Yeah, oh, absolutely, yeah. Yeah, to go back to your question about what do I look for, it's about what fits into the collection as well. There's so many fantastic watches out there, so you've kind of got to narrow it down a little bit. And once you've been in it for a while and you've hopefully kind of narrowed down your tastes a bit and got some pieces you're really happy with, for me it's probably just staying put until something, you know, particularly special comes out of the blue. And if you try to cover every base of every complication, every brand that resonates with you, you can keep going forever.
Yeah, that's sort of like a completionist approach.
Mm-hmm.
You have to get all complications or colors.
or different metals. Somebody wants, like, I've got a brass watch, I've got a bronze watch, and there is a ceramic watch in there, but it's my wife's watch.
So would you be happy with this collection if you owned it?
Yes, very happy.
Yeah, I think it's a fantastic collection. It's you've got two pretty special complications, a lot of heritage, and then you've got a wonderful kind of not time only because it has a dial bezel, but still a watch that has a lot of context over its impact. These would cover you pretty well for all those protocols, I think. I mean, you know, your black tie meant to be time only, you might fall afoul there, but I think we can forgive you.
And the great thing about it is we didn't really collaborate as to what watches we were bringing, so it's a case of...
That's a good point,
They're the three watches that ended up on...
Yeah, I think it came together very well, given there was no minimal coordination here, so...
So you have to challenge somebody else next.
All right. Well, let's see who steps up to the table next. Until, thanks for coming in, and thanks for watching.